Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, it's been about 100 years since the end of the First World War, then known as the Great War. It's hard to comprehend the toll it took in lives just by looking at the numbers. But let's look at the numbers, because in that more than four-year war, 9 million soldiers died. That's three times the population of Iowa. 21 million wounded. The countries involved, Germany, Russia, Austria-Hungary, that was a country at the time, France, Great Britain, each of those countries lost nearly a million or more lives. And in addition, at least 5 million civilians died from disease, starvation, or exposure. Now, the U.S. entered the First World War late, 1917. It lost our country over 100,000 military personnel, and I'm sure you've seen these on memorial days. As you go through grave sites, you'll see soldiers, lives lost, grave markers dating back to the First World War. Well, my guest today is a writer whose latest novel is set in the aftermath of that horrific war, Nick Dybeck. His latest novel, The Verdun Affair, is set in Europe in the aftermath of World War I, also juxtaposed with scenes from Los Angeles in the 1950s. It's about a lonely young man, a beautiful widow, and an amnesiac soldier nicknamed Douglas Fairbanks, a silent film actor from that time. Kirkus Reviews praises the novel with these words: "In delicate, evocative prose, Dybeck captures the grim devastation of scarred battlefields, bombed villages, and fetid soil, and conveys with sensitivity his character's unabated desire to see in the shell-shocked soldier an answer to their deepest desire, a familiar love triangle reimagined in an absorbing tale." Nick Dybeck joins me in our Iowa City studio today. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And you are I want to mention from the get-go, you are a graduate of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop, so this is returning to some home turf. How many years ago were you in Iowa City for your stint?
Well, I was a student here between 2003 and 2005, so where does the time go? It's been a while now, but I am always excited to come back to Iowa City. It actually still very much feels like home to me.
So, So set this up. The time and place that this novel takes place. I mentioned a little bit about the Great War, but we have Verdun here, a battle here. Talk about the setting and what attracted you about this setting to put your characters in it.
Well, I began work on this book because of something I heard on the radio, actually. It was about 2010 or 11, and I was driving home from work listening to the BBC, and there was a story about a memorial service that was being held to commemorate the Battle of Verdun at this place called the Dumont Ossuary. And the story itself really wasn't about where it was taking place. That was just kind of mentioned as part of the texture of it, but I had never heard of this place, the Dumont Ossuary. An ossuary is a place where bones are collected and stored, and often as a memorial. And there was one detail that caught my attention in the story, which was that all of these, and there's thousands of them in this Dumont Ossuary, which is just outside of Verdun, and they were collected over many years by just a few people. And I immediately thought, what if that was your job? You know, what if your morning was getting up and walking out over these scarred moonscape-like battlefields, picking up bones every day? How would you, what does that do to you psychologically as a person? And what that image really gave me was a way into a world that I had been interested in for a long time, but that just seemed like a sort of starting point to kind of access writing something about the aftermath of the war that I had sort of wanted to.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit more about Verdun, one of the most infamous battles of the war. It lasted a little less than a year, but what nearly a million people in one battle dying?
Yeah, it's the what is typically called the Battle of Verdun, though there was fighting all around the area for much longer than this, took place between February and December of 1916. There were about a combined 1 million casualties in that time. And, there are a number of things that are infamous, terrifying, noteworthy. I'm not sure what adjective applies exactly. But, number one was that it was, maybe the kind of most famous example of this new style of warfare, which is war of attrition. Historians debate exactly what the German strategy was and how it was conceived, but it is at least arguable that they weren't really trying to take territory in this battle. You know, that the old rules of warfare, the old strategies of warfare, which involves taking an enemy's territory, don't actually apply here. What they wanted to do was pick a place they knew the French would defend at all costs. And then, in the words of the general, the German general Falkenhayn, who was the orchestrator of the strategy, he said, "You know, I want to bleed them white," which basically means I want them to have to defend. You know, I want to punish them basically and win that way.
Attrition,
war of attrition, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And also getting back to the ossuary too here. So people picking up bones would have had for years a lot of work to do. Descriptions of Verdun are shells coming in, at such a rate that you may have a trench impacted, you may have men literally blown apart, and then more shells coming, and so. You have, I don't know how you put this without getting too graphic, this is a graphic war. You have bits, literally bits and pieces of men mixed together with soil, layers and layers of that.
Yeah. If you read firsthand accounts of what it was like to be in the battle, I mean, it sounds absolutely apocalyptic. It was not the deadliest World War I battle. You know, more people died at the Somme, for example. But what's noteworthy about Verdun is just how short the front was, meaning that it was this really dense conflict where, thousands and thousands of explosive shells are being fired. The front is changing all of the time. So consequently, by the time the war was over, you have this great expansive battlefield that is absolutely littered with uncollected bits of people. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I try not to think too symbolically as a writer, but and kind of focus more on the characters. But when you, that's a pretty powerful symbolic image of this job of picking up these bones, picking up literally these pieces that don't fit together anymore, right? Mm.
If you just joined us, Nick Dybeck is my guest. His latest novel, The Verdun Affair, set in Europe in the aftermath of the First World War. Let's talk about the characters that you put into this horrific scene. The horror of it is fading when this novel starts, because we have the young man, Tom Combs. Mm-hmm. And tell us about him. And he's an American who is there in post-war Europe, and tell us a little bit about him and why he's there.
Well, Tom comes to Verdun. He kind of as an orphan. His mother dies. His father, who he's been estranged from most of his life, is working as a surgeon with on a group called the American Field Service, which was involved in the war in Europe prior to the United States government actually getting involved officially. And so that's what brings him to the area in the months before the actual Battle of Verdun starts. Then his father passes away, and Tom finds himself sort of adopted by one of the priests who runs the Diocese of Verdun. And because he doesn't feel like he really has a reason to go back to, and because, like many people during World War I, he initially finds this as a sort of exciting opportunity. You know, he's only a teenager at the time, so he doesn't quite realize exactly.
15 years old, right?
Yeah, at the time that he comes and at the time that the battle starts. And so, I think he has no conception of sort of what awaits him and sort of wants to stay and, do his part and so on and so forth. And he manages to live out the war. He works when he becomes old enough as an ambulance driver, which to him actually is a kind of a class symbol. Again, the early American involvement was mostly upper class people before the military actually got involved. You know, there was a little bit of privilege actually in being in the American field service. And so this is something that Tom desires as well. And eventually he, through his friendships with the priests that he makes during the war, he ends up staying on to help them as a kind of assistant build this ossuary. And then they have another job which is just as important as that, which is that after the war, Verdun has become this this place of pilgrimage, really. There are so many people that have lost loved ones who are either missing and they're desperate for information about them, or just come because this is where their son or husband died and they just want to see it for closure. And so part of Tom's job is to help these people along as well.
Right. I'd like to ask you, Nick, to read from your novel here. And we talked about collecting these bones. One section here, I don't know if you need to set this up any further, that describes these young men, these boys, working to collect the bones.
One of the things that I thought was interesting that I discovered in researching this is just how ubiquitous Verdun was to so many of French people in the aftermath of the war. It's a place that Boy Scout troops would go to. It was a place that was actually this site of tourism because it was a real symbol of French resilience and victory. And then there were all these other groups that were actually would help in the collecting of these bones. And so the section I'll read details that a little bit. And it talks about this place called Fleury, which is a little village outside of Verdun that was destroyed during the war and consequently never rebuilt. So we'd been over Fleury and almost every other inch of battlefield many times already, but it seemed each time I returned, there were more bones. Father Gaillard had said my grandchildren would still find bones in Verdun. We just needed to ensure that they find as few as possible. It was lonely work, certainly, but I wasn't always alone. Tourists began to arrive before the war was even over, filing through the streets in solemn groups. Soldiers in wheelchairs waited under melted street lamps, pointing the way to the next site of mourning and triumph. Here was Vauban's citadel, where Pétain and Neville strategized the first creeping barrage. Here was the Voie Sacrée, the sacred road from which poured the material that would save the city, the war, the nation. After the armistice, the tours leapt into the battlefield. To Father Gaillard and Father Perrin, visiting Verdun or Artois or Champ des Dames was something near to a civic duty. The battlefields would be gone soon, overgrown, cleaned up, and then what? Were we to expect people just to remember? The previous spring, boys from a Catholic school in Tourcoing had spent their vacation on bicycles helping to collect the bones. The young priest who accompanied them spent much of the time drunk in his tent. In his absence, I helped the boys gather bones in baskets. I walked them to the provisional ossuary like a crossing guard, though they weren't many years younger than I. Some of these boys worked like the devil, keeping their eyes on the ground, holding the bones as if they were fragile things, still in need of protection. These boys knew not to smile or laugh much, to turn away at the jokes of their friends. Some of the others sang songs to pass the time and talked about schoolwork and the St. Rosaline girls on the other side of their town. Once, one of the boys picked up a leg bone from the mud and stroked it as if it were his penis. It took the others a moment to laugh, and a less determined comedian might have given up. But when he began to moan, to lick his lips, the crowd that had gathered broke into chuckles. They laughed hard when the bone broke apart in his hands, and he said in mock horror, "My God, Father Soucy warned me this might happen." Some of the boys looked to me as if I might punish him, but punish him how? Of course, many of them were scared out of their minds. They refused to ride the bicycles unless the asphalt was new, and though it was safe enough as long as you knew what you were doing, they had reason to be cautious. If you did something foolish, like pick up a grenade, then perhaps you deserved what you got.
My guest, Nick Dybeck, reading from his latest novel, The Verdun Affair. And that is, so the first-person view of of Tom Combs, telling about being involved in post-war Europe in the area of Verdun here. I wonder, in that reading too, it really gives us a feeling of what this collection was like. How did you inform yourself what that was like, what that must have been like to collect these bones?
Well, it was, you know, mostly a work of imagination, honestly. I did travel. One of the first things I did in writing the book was travel to Verdun and walked some of these same areas that I would later have my narrator walking. And it's very striking to go there. The ground around much of it still looks like waves. You know, all the shell holes are still there. It's still full of these crumbling forts that now you can pay a couple of euros and go see. And the ground is still littered with ordnance. And in fact, I think, you know, just about every year somebody actually dies still.
Really?
From picking up a grenade or some other, you know, explosive ordnance that is still there. And interestingly enough, you know, I mean, I don't know exactly what the geological process is behind this, but, you know, there, all this, you know, I kind of wonder, like, how could these things be around 100 years later, right? And apparently they, you know, the things that were once 20 feet underground are kind of, you know, have worked their way up to the surface, like, over the years, and are continuing to do that and may continue to do that for, well, we don't know how long.
We've got a few minutes before we take a break and come back, and I wanted to make sure in the remaining 5 or 6 minutes that we are introduced to the other main characters, because this is, after all, a love story, in a way, in this curious setting. Introduce us to Sarah Hagen. How does she enter the picture with Tom?
So Sarah Hagen is also an American, and she and Tom meet because, like so many other people, she comes to Verdun looking desperately, kind of irrationally, for some news of her husband who disappeared during the war.
Lee Hagen.
Lee Hagen, exactly. And Tom is kind of low on the food chain, so it's not normally his job to speak directly with someone like Sarah Hagen. That would more fall to one of the priests who he works for. But because he's an American and she's an American, the priest he works for asks him to speak with her. And he frankly doesn't do a very good job. He, for reasons he doesn't quite understand at the time, tells her that he knew her husband during the war, which is a lie. And that is kind of, in some ways, the hinge that the rest of the plot kind of turns on.
Right, and he falls in love with her, and then this lie haunts him because that's how he got his in, right?
Exactly.
So he's struggling to be honest with this woman he's fallen in love with, but the hinge, as you say, is the lie. So we have Sarah Hagen, and then we have the other main character.
Yeah, his name is Paul. He is an Austrian veteran, now a journalist. And they don't meet him. He appears early in the frame of the book. In fact, it's a chance encounter at a funeral many years later in Los Angeles where Tom runs into Paul. That is kind of the Madeline that brings all of this back to bear for him in his mind. But they don't meet until the sort of second act of the book, which takes place in Italy.
Douglas Fairbanks, that's a nickname for a character here. This is the object of much press attention, as you describe in this book. It's the great mystery at the center of this novel. Tell us about him. Is he, he's a shell shock, to use the term of the day. Today we'd say PTSD, an extremely traumatized soldier, right?
That's right. That's right.
And who is this individual?
So in the novel, he is a soldier that has shell shock, that has perhaps amnesia, though he's very uncommunicative, and nobody knows who he is. He's been repatriated from a Austrian prisoner of war camp and has wound up in a sort of mental hospital in Bologna, Italy. And Tom, Sarah, and Paul all find themselves drawn to Bologna, sort of to his bedside, and they all have different ideas about who he actually is.
Mm-hmm. And he cannot speak. He doesn't remember. At the beginning, he doesn't speak at all, right?
He can actually speak, but he will only talk, you know, he doesn't say much, and under hypnosis, he will be a little bit more forthcoming, but is very... you know, either doesn't remember or doesn't want to remember sort of who he is, and is make sure not to divulge that.
Mm-hmm. This character nicknamed Douglas Fairbanks after the silent movie star of the day. Is this based on unreal people? I imagine you must have researched shell-shocked soldiers of which there were a great many at this time, right?
He is. He's actually based on a French shell-shocked soldier whose name was Anselme Magin. And this is a really fascinating story, I think. Much like Douglas Fairbanks, Magin was in a German prisoner of war camp and repatriated with a bunch of his fellows at the end of the war. He showed up at a train station in Paris without any identification, and eventually wound up in a mental hospital in France. And the fascinating thing about him was that the doctors, because they couldn't identify him, they published his picture in the paper saying, we have this man, we don't know who he is. Here, he's, you know, 5 feet, 3 inches tall, though they wouldn't have said it in English measure, obviously. He has brown eyes, et cetera, et cetera. And they got thousands of responses from people saying, oh, that's my son. That's my husband.
Even though they'd provided the picture, and it couldn't possibly be so.
And
right?
Many of them were utterly irrational. You know, they would write letters saying things like, well, you know, my son, Jean, was 6 feet. But it's possible that, you know, because of the stress, he has shrunk 6 inches, you know, or... you know, I know that my son, you know, Marcel had blue eyes and Mangin's are brown, but, didn't I read something about how eye color can change under certain conditions?
Right.
They would talk about, you know, various dreams they had that suggested that there was evidence that heartbreaking. And really, to me, was one of the things I read that really crystallized for me just how pervasive the grief was and how irrational the hope. And that's really what Douglas Fairbanks becomes for all of my characters. He is this kind of irrational vessel that is blank, that they are trying to pour what they want into.
Nick Dybeck is my guest. We'll have to go away for just a few minutes. I hope you'll come back and listen to the rest of this conversation. His latest novel, The Verdun Affair, as you've been hearing, set in Europe in the aftermath of the First World War. Very interesting setting, unusual setting for a love affair. We'll hear a little bit more about that when we come back. Nick Dybeck, my guest, The Verdun Affair. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Nick Dybeck is my guest. He's a graduate of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. And he's got another novel out. This is his second novel, The Verdun Affair, set in Europe in the aftermath of World War I, also juxtaposed with scenes from the 1950s. It's a love story, but a very interesting, a curious setting in the post-war period in this particular place near and surrounding Verdun, one of the most infamous battles of the First World War, where about 1 million lives were lost in the course of about a year. Nick, I wanted to ask you to read again, and this takes us back to your main character, Tom, working before the time of picking up the bones. The war is still going on. Tell us about this tent where they're essentially doing triage, right?
Yeah. As I mentioned before, when Tom first comes to France, his father is a surgeon working with this organization called the American Field Service. And so the passage I'm going to read, one day Tom comes to visit him, but he is insanely busy, as was often the case. And so this is important in the book because it's the moment when Tom first meets this Father Gaillard, who will ultimately become his friend and guardian after Tom's father dies. And Father Gaillard asks him to help him with a job he has to do while he's at this triage hospital. And that job is to go into this place called the Moribund Ward, which is a tent in this case, but it essentially means it's a place where people who are not dead yet, but they are fairly sure are going to die, are left. And the reason why they're left there is so the doctors know not to waste valuable time treating them, essentially. Father Gaillard relieved the nurse and opened the notebook to a page near the back. Mark a cross next to each name at my nod, would you, Tom? The task was mercifully easy. I followed him from bed to bed as he inquired after the needs of the few soldiers who were conscious, said prayers for those who weren't, and, just before passing on to the next bed, gently touched the tip of each soldier's nose with his palm. If he nodded, I drew a careful cross in the margin next to the name. Only later did I understand that we had arrived at the Moribund Ward, that these men were not expected to survive and could not be afforded the doctor's precious time. Only later did I understand that it was the chaplain's responsibility to write to these men's families in order to prepare them, but that the inevitable dying could go on for weeks, sometimes months. If the nose was cold, if the cross was marked, it was time to begin the letter. Even to my 15-year-old mind, such a method did not seem especially scientific or sound. Yet, when I asked my father, he said Father Gaillard was seldom wrong. In fact, 3 months later, I watched Father Gaillard touch my father's nose in just that way. Soon after, he began to administer extreme unction, and soon after that, he pulled the blanket over my father's face. Later that afternoon, Father Gaillard drove me back to Verdun himself, offering anecdotes about the parishes we passed on the way. More than once, I thought he might cry. "How do you feel, Tom?" he asked. Mostly I felt angry that Father Gaillard seemed more affected by my father's death than I was. Tom, he said, his English was good, but with his accent, my name sounded like Tom. He kept repeating it, Tom, Tom, Tom. I've gotten to know your father well. You might not be aware, but he was a decent man in many ways, and he would want me to help you. You think that you don't have a choice about what happens now, but you do. Have you thought about what you want? I'd already thought plenty about what I didn't want. The steamer ride home, the train ride across the northeast, coasting past Chicago's squealing stockyards. I thought of the kind but thinly stretched Rileys waiting at Union Station, then the familiar hall smelling of cabbage, the familiar stairs, and the apartment where I'd lived all my life with my mother, no doubt filled with someone else now, peering out, wondering who the new boy was.
I wonder if this main character through which we live this novel is also based on a historical figure, or is this a purely fictional? There could have been someone like this.
He's pretty much purely fictional. Certainly, I relied on a lot of primary sources to draft really all of these characters, and so there are little bits of his experience that are that I found in letters and things like that. Interestingly enough, I mean, I there's one thing I had to kind of do some gymnastics around was how do you get an American involved in this intensely and French endeavor, you know? Right. And Verdun in particular was this is a huge deal for the French. Even now, it has this significance. It's kind of like D-Day and 9/11 and Pearl Harbor kind of rolled into one. There's all this, you know, very sort of national and nationalistic pride associated with it. So what's an American doing there was one question that I had to answer. And part of the answer is just the circumstances about how he got there, which I've already discussed. But another part of the answer is that when the ossuary was built, a lot of it was done with private donations, and a lot of those private donations were from Americans. And so it sort of made sense that there would be a capitalistic sort of logic to these priests asking an American to kind of stay and help them as their assistant, in order to help raise the money to build this project that was so important to them.
Mm-hmm. Another way, I'm remembering a scene, the very interesting way in which you introduce Americans into this war is Tom, by this time, is sort of a veteran of knowing what it's like to be at the front, right? Going through the trenches, and sometimes these are very elaborate trenches. And relay the scene where he meets, what is it, three new American doughboys, as they were considered, and they're all gung-ho. They have not been to the front. And what happens?
Yeah, so he, as you said, he at the moment that this scene occurs, he's been in France and in Verdun. He's kind of survived the battle by this point, and is a bit jaded, I suppose you could say. And the Americans didn't show up right until the last months of the war. And like everyone else, when they came in, their uniforms are clean. They got these clean helmets. And to Tom, there's something kind of offensive in that. In their confidence or their gusto or something, and so he does this kind of cruel thing where he leads them to this famous this place existed,
but they ask for it, right?
Well, they say, we'd like to see the front. We're not quite sure how we get up to the front line, the front trench. And he says, "Well, there's not much actually happening today. Let me take you to this other place." And so he leads them to this German bunker that was built in a very presciently named area of the battlefield called Mort Home, the Dead Man. It's this ancient hill, which that's what it had always been called, but it gained a lot more significance during the Battle of Verdun. And in this hill, the Germans, when they held the territory, had built this very elaborate underground bunker that was full of fancy furniture and operating rooms and electric lighting. And when the French, as was often happening during the Battle of the Verdun, when the French took that territory again, the Germans refused to surrender it. And so the French killed everybody inside, essentially, and left all the corpses inside. And so Tom leads these new clean pressed American soldiers to this tunnel and says, "Well, if you want to see it, go in there." And they kind of eagerly go in. And what he doesn't tell them is that it's completely full of corpses.
Mm. If you just joined us, Nick Dybeck is my guest, talking about The Verdun Affair, his latest novel set in the aftermath of the First World War. I don't know, other things, so many interesting things. I didn't mention that at the outset, and we're nearing the end of this conversation. Nick, I absolutely love this novel. I should have mentioned that right at the beginning.
I'm just, it's okay, you got to it eventually.
Yeah, I'm just so focused on it and enmeshed in your narrative here that I neglected to say that. It's really an interesting novel set in a time and a place that has always, I assume that we share this, that has always fascinated those of us living now, 100 years after the end of the First World War. Let's talk about a couple of other things. One here in a small scene, this actually dives into the 1950s section of it. This has to do with a screenplay. Iowa makes its way into this novel, specifically Mount Vernon.
That's right.
Tell us in what way it finds itself into a screenplay.
So, that's actually a little complicated to explain. Tom early in the novel, tells Sarah, the woman that he falls in love with, that he knew her husband during the war. And when she presses him for details about what he knew of them, what kind of interactions they had together, he tells her this story about a conversation he had with a different person. I mean, not at all someone he at all thought was her husband that he met. And this guy sings, when they meet, he sings him this song that he wrote. And so then Tom, remembers the song and relates it to Sarah. And the song is kind of another one of the sort of hinges that the plot is built around, which maybe I'll spare the details of some of the plot points about how that works. But suffice to say that it haunts him for a long time. And after he meets Paul again in 1950s Hollywood, where he's a screenwriter, he's supposed to be helping to work with a famous composer named Max Steiner to write some lyrics for this song that's going to go in a spy picture. And they get drunk at a party one night, and because all these memories are flooding back and they're kind of going over what the lyrics could possibly be, he starts singing the words to this song that he had once sang to Sarah so many years ago, and immediately regrets it. But, Max Steiner, the powerful Hollywood composer, says, "Oh, that's perfect. We're going to put this in a film." So there's actually a little scene of him kind of in horror watching the dailies of this film as it's shot. And it becomes in this kind of cheesy spy picture the code to unlock this like hypnotized guy's who has been implanted with some like Russian espionage secrets,
right?
And so the idea is that his mother has to actually sing it to him. It's a lullaby, so he calls his mother,
and that unlocks the code. He hears not only the lullaby, but it has to be in the voice of his mother.
Exactly. It's very complicated. and his mother is in Mount Vernon, Iowa. Exactly.
Okay. Why did you pick Mount Vernon? I mean, you're having spent several years in Iowa City, you're very acquainted with Mount Vernon. It's a beautiful community.
It certainly is. As I said at the outset, Iowa City and Iowa, the whole area around here is very important to me. It just feels like a part of my home. And I don't know if I could say exactly why Mount Vernon of all places. I mean, it just is a nice sounding name, I think, that I felt would be evocative in the scene. For better or for worse, I mean, I think that we, and I don't think this is all fair, because I find Iowa to be an extremely specific place, but there is, I think, a larger notion of it being the Americana of American, like, if you're looking for like what is the blue blood of, just...
Right, and I wanted to get to that, because in literary terms or in film terms, Iowa is referenced, and I don't know if anybody's ever done this, but look at all the Iowa references in film and literature over decades, mm-hmm. to try to distill what it is that writers like you, maybe not all writers, I'm probably overgeneralizing, what is meant by a person from Iowa or Iowa's identity when it pops up in some work of fiction?
That's a great question. Yeah, I mean, I immediately think of, Captain Kirk is from Iowa, isn't that right?
Just south of Iowa City. Riverside, Iowa. Yes.
Riverside, exactly, yeah. For me, I picked Iowa because the story that I was telling is about an American that's very far from home, that's very far, that has gotten involved in all of this kind of crazy espionage stuff, and has been, kind of in the vein of a Hitchcock movie, has been, tailed through these various European capitals. And the call to his mother is supposed to be this call to the sort of the very heart of his childhood and the core of who he is and, what he's trying to get back to. And I think in the popular imagination, Iowa, at least for a lot of people, plays that role.
I wanted to talk a little bit, ask you a little bit before we say goodbye about your time at the University of Iowa. You attended the prestigious Writers Workshop at the University of Iowa. When was that?
I began in 2003 to 2006.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe your time at the workshop those 3 years?
Transformative, really.
In what ways?
Well, I was there... at an interesting time, a time of transition, because I was in the last class that Frank Conroy taught, and I was there for Sam Chang's interview process. In fact, when she interviewed for the job, it was one of my stories that she workshopped at her sort of sample class. Mm-hmm. And so it was an interesting time to be there because there was, I think, you know, this kind of, I was right in the middle of the transition from, you know, and these categories I don't think are exactly fair, but from the very sort of old school sort of writer's workshop to transitioning into something a little newer and, you know, sort of leaving some of the kind of classic tropes of what the culture was like, you know, the boys club notion of it and you know, it still very much had the reputation then of being this very competitive, backbiting, sometimes kind of toxic place.
Right, and Frank Conroy was one who was known to, if he felt like it, if it so moved him, not pull any punches when a book was being workshopped.
Yes, I can attest to that personally.
You actually witnessed that, or were the the target?
I more than witnessed it. Yeah, I felt it. Yeah, I mean, I had the fortune or misfortune, I suppose you could say, of having the very first story up for workshop the semester I had with Frank, and I was warned against volunteering to do that, I have to say, because you know, the sort of the conventional wisdom was that, you know, Frank kind of really wants to sort of set the tone.
First person,
It was a shredding indeed. Which, you know, I did
deserved.
I would have to go by. I mean, partially, certainly. And whether it was, you know, I mean, deserved or not isn't even how I think about it now. You know, what I think about it is I certainly didn't enjoy sitting in class that hour. I will admit that, but I learned a lot from that. I mean, and just Frank's. Not always the most diplomatic guy, but his passion for writing sentences and just the very fact that he could get so worked up about one word chosen instead of the other was kind of amazing.
Right, you know? And you wouldn't know this, but before Frank died, he was on this show a number of times. He actually, you know, had several books, one about Nantucket, I remember.
Yeah, of course.
And I remember, you know, a little glimpse into my life is before we interview an author, I kind of generally just say what attracts me about their book or what I want to talk about in an interview. And with Frank, and in the number of times that I interviewed him also about his jazz music, which he loved, he always had a singular response when I would suggest, okay, in a few minutes when we talk, when we go on broadcast, should we talk about this or can you talk about that? And he never committed to it. He always says, if it feels right. So yep. In that way, he was jazz. Right. I thought he was jazz through and through because he would not commit himself to a composition of conversation. Only, sure, Ben, if it feels right.
Right.
Does that sound like Frank to you?
That's a great story. Yeah, I mean, Frank, even as a teacher now, you know, there's a lot of what I learned from Frank that I still talk to my students about, you know, every single quarter. And I think that this is important because of how many people skim over things like sentences. And, you know, to Frank, it mattered. It mattered what choices you make. And that is something that I still remind myself of, you know, that you don't take a shortcut. Don't write it the easy way, you know, write it the way that feels right, I guess, you know.
And work at it, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
You mentioned teaching. You teach at Oregon State University now. That's also where you live, of course. I wanted to mention before we go to your father, Stuart Dybeck, is a nationally known author of fiction, poetry. I wonder, also a graduate of the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop.
He was, yeah.
So connect a few dots for me here about the influence of your father. I imagine he said, you've got to go to the workshop. I'm just imagining that.
He did not say that. He said, you should go be a marine biologist.
Did he really?
I mean, you know, I'm joking, you know, but he has always been very supportive of my creative work in just about every way, but also was, you know, quick to say, this is not an easy gig. And like many people that have sustained long careers doing it, you know, I think you hear the same piece of advice. You know, you really should only do this if you absolutely have to.
If you're compelled to do it, if you have personally no other choice.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And so there certainly was never any, you know, pressure, carry on the family business or something like that, you know, quite the contrary. But once, you know, I think it was clear to him and to me that this was something that that I did have to do, then he's been nothing but supportive since then. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, Nick, we've run out of time. It's been a real pleasure talking with you. I wish you good luck on working on your third novel. It is a novel.
It is, yep.
It is a novel. Nick's latest novel is The Verdun Affair. Do check it out. I really enjoyed it, especially if you're fascinated by this period of European history, the First World War, and its aftermath. Nick Dybeck, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much, Ben. It's been my pleasure.
And that does it for this edition of River to River. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.